Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About.
Meet Jane Yolen and extract meaning from the rhythm in the words. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 365 of the podcast with Jane Yolen. 365! There is now an episode for every day of the year if you want to go on a podcast-a-thon with All the Wonders. How about that? And what a special guest to join me to celebrate. You may have read one or two or 50 of Jane's over 350 books, and you may have a particular title that feels like your book. Like it was written for you, like it reflects something about you back when you read it. This book did that for me in a beautiful way that the text, as it turns out, revealed itself to Jane as well. The book's called On Duck Pond, and you'll learn more about it in this chat, and there are images as well included in the episode show notes. There's so much magic in this conversation, and I hope it reaches and inspires you the way that talking to Jane did me. Here's episode number 365 of the podcast with Jane Yolen. Welcome to the podcast, Jane Yolen. I get to talk to you again.
Hello. Hello, Matthew.
I've missed you. It's been such fun since New York, but I feel like I have a Jane Yolen-sized hole in my heart.
Oh,
not going to lie.
Thank you. I'm going to take that with me for at least a week or two.
Well, apparently, though, a couple of my friends were like, oh, you're talking to Jane tonight. And then they told their Jane stories of how they've been at retreats at your house. They've been here. They've been there. And isn't she the best at conferences? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm fully expecting to just, like, fall asleep tonight with a smile permanently on my face, as I did in New York. Just you sort of exude love for me, and I think to many other people. So, you know, before we talk about books, just thanks. Thanks for being you.
Thank you.
I think that where I want to go next as a librarian, where I feel compelled to go next, is just to say that you are a presence in our library, in our classrooms, in our daily reading habits. It's a beautiful thing for me to be in this place where I get to talk to you firsthand after knowing the impact you've already had on my life and the impact you've had on the lives of the children that I work with and the teachers that I work with because of how prolific you are with your writing and your craft. So you are a person that just by reading you, I've learned a lot. And that continues with, we'll talk about Undock Pond, but I could hold up any one of your books, and I feel like I'm always learning with you and alongside you, and that's a special thing that you give your readers. So thank you for that as well.
That's also something wonderful about being a writer, is that anything I'm interested in, I can spend days, weeks, months learning about call it research, take it off my income tax, and write a book. And it's like a gift every time I sit down to try to write another book. It doesn't have to be a nonfiction book. It can be a fiction book. But I'm still learning. I'm learning stuff all the time. And to be a lifelong learner is one of the great joys of being a writer.
See, right there, you use that phrase that is like the phrase that's embroidered on all of our librarian uniforms, lifelong learner, the thing that we seek to live out by example with our children. And to hear you use that phrase, it just, I think it is the why to every single book that I see with your name on it. Just, well, why go here? Why go there? Because you're curious. I could talk to you about whales washing up on shore. I could talk to you about ducks. I could talk to you about noises underground. And I can tell that it's just that you're curious. And then you share what you find out with us. You sort of report back.
You know, I call it something else. I don't call it just curious. I call it being engaged with the world. Mm. Because if you it's like, I don't understand people who say they're retired. It sounds like you're tired again.
Retired.
Yeah, I'm retired. I'm tired again. I've done too much. I'm done. Well, you're not. You know, you're going to learn something new every day of your life. It's exciting.
It is. And I wonder if there's a point, I wonder even in my adulthood, if I'm still learning things, but for some reason I'm not allowing myself to own that, hey buddy, you're still learning. That's what this is. That's what's going on right now, is that you're learning.
Well, you know, we have this thing in school where we think learning stops at 3 o'clock, begins at 9, stops at 3, or 8:30 and 2:30, however, you know, your school goes. And then it stops after you get out of college, or after you get out of high school, or after you get out of junior high school. And that's not true. Well, it's not true for most people. But because we know that learning stops when you get out of school, right? Then we fool ourselves into thinking that we're not learning something all along the way. You have a child, you learn new things. You have an illness, you learn new things. You have you learn a new language. Worlds open up to you. You learn how to bird watch. You see walking outside differently. You learn to scuba dive, and suddenly the whole ocean becomes a new learning place. So we don't stop learning, but we maybe don't call it that anymore.
I can understand that in such a profound way right now because of some of the emotional learning I'm doing now, understanding who I am and why I act certain ways, and understanding that it's like, oh, I'm wired this way, and that wiring can be undone and reassociated. And it's just a fascinating thing to understand that learning can take place inside us as well, and in the way that we perceive things, in addition to what we perceive.
Yeah. It's just a bunch of us who are poets have been writing various things to one another online, and I had written a poem that ended with it started with a quote from Ursula Le Guin about how writing is really about the rhythm in the words. And if you don't get that rhythm, you don't get to your meaning. And I was talking, I took that and I started writing a poem about that a writer gets into a boat and is rocked by the boat. And that rocking develops into, in a sense, a learning thing. And the image that I end with is that you pick up, and the writer then picks up the coiled shell of the story. And somebody else picked up the image of the coiled shell and wrote it into her poem. You know, so that we not only learn something every day, but we teach something every day, even without meaning to. You might say something to someone and it suddenly breaks them open in new ways. It may be just a passing comment, or I might say to you, have you read this book? And I loved the book. You read it and it changed your life.
Yes.
You know, so every time we have any kind of interaction, if the interaction is with one another, with a book, with nature, with politics, with history, with anything, it changes us sometimes in small ways, sometimes in profound ways. We are teachers and we are learners all our lives.
Mm. Yes, yes. Let me take us out to On Duck Pond for a moment, because the images coming to my mind are ones also that I see as an observer and a learner and also a teacher in this book that you share. In this poem on Duck Pond, what starts to me, at least what I felt, every time I've read it, it's felt this way. What has felt starting out as a walk out onto this pond to watch, observe these animals, the ducks landing on the pond, the way that the water ripples, just these things, to take it from there to where ultimately it goes into our reflections in the water, the way we see ourselves, right?
And they change.
And the way they change. And the way they change, and then I think perhaps more importantly, become clear again.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe clearer.
Clearer. There was something that I just couldn't shake every time I read this. I was taken aback by the idea that the book itself was acting, the text, the illustrations that Bob created, all of it together, were also working as this still pond that was being rippled and then made clear again through the course of the story. I just thought that was something that's so beautiful that you were able to, in your poem and in the way you choreograph those words, able to accomplish the same thing through the medium of the picture book itself at the same time.
Yeah. You know, our family loves at holidays to get one of these 1,500 piece
jigsaw puzzles. Oh, we are. I knew we were of the same cloth. I knew that.
So you see that full picture on the top of the jigsaw puzzle. But what you have are all these little pieces. It's as if the ducks have come and scattered them all, right?
Yes.
Little pieces. And slowly, and it takes all of us, not just one of us, but all of us, adding a little piece here, a little piece there. My daughter-in-law loves to work the whole the outside line, because that once she gets that in, she's very good at seeing and matching colors. Whereas I just look at one little piece that's missing for an hour and then find it. You know, we each have different ways of putting the pond back together again. And I think this is, that's just a metaphor, really. That's a visual metaphor, the jigsaw puzzle. But all of us, we have times we're shattered in our lives. We find ways to put ourselves together, or to put a friend together, or to offer one piece that might be missing in their lives. And I think that for many people, books are that piece, or a story, or song, or poem, something that seems just ordinary, or, oh yeah, I read that, or, oh yeah, I heard that poem, but it didn't do anything for me, but it changed the life of someone. And I get letters all the time about this book or that book of mine, or this poem or that poem of mine, or that has literally changed someone's circumstance. And I go, you know, if I had been asked to write a poem to change that person's circumstance. I couldn't have done it. I wrote something out of my heart, and whatever it was, that's how a book goes. It's written by someone, it's read by someone, but the story is made between them. So you read a story with your own background and your own baggage that you're reading the story with, and you take from it what you need. Someone else may never see exactly the same thing. I'll give you, for instance, a friend of mine recently, this is 2 days ago, we were sitting around having tea. And she said to me, she was listening to, she and I are in a band together. And she was listening to one of our bandmates. We were doing a recording, and she was listening to one of her bandmates, our bandmates, doing a song that I had written the lyrics to about a Selkie. And a Selkie is a creature who's out of folklore, who's a seal in the water, but comes ashore, takes off their coat, and becomes a human being. And sometimes a watching fisherman steals the coat of a Selkie girl and forces her to come home with him, be his wife, bear his children. But there's always a turning in that story where she finds the hidden cloak. She puts it on because all she's wanted to do is to go back into the sea. Mm. And she was listening to this song, and she said she'd heard it many times, and it was as if suddenly it became clear to her that it was the story of her life, that she had been, in a sense, raised by wolves. She said she had a very difficult childhood and had never come to terms totally and forgiven her mother for the way she was raised. And suddenly she realized that music for her had put the coat back on, and she was ready to dive back into life again. Oh, and I just shivered when she told me, and I said, you found your agency. You found your ability to put your own coat back on. You did that for yourself. No, I didn't do it for you. The song didn't do it for you. The poem didn't do it for you. You found that poem, that song, and you took it in the way you needed it. And you then went back into the sea. And for her, the metaphor in that was so strong that she's healed herself. But again, I couldn't have written that song for her. I couldn't have written that poem for her if she had said to me, write to me something about this. It wouldn't have been that song. It wouldn't have done its work. So, you know, I'm very aware of the fact that I put into all of my books, I put me into it.
Yes.
But it's not what you get out of it. You get you out of it.
I get me out of it through the story that we share between, by you putting you in it.
Right.
There's some resonancy there that just, you know, the intonation matches with mine, overlaps with mine at this one place. But then it continues off with me in a different, potentially, a different direction. It takes meaning a different way. It's the way that, yeah, it's the way that that book can say, where you can say, it feels like this book was written for me. It feels like this is my life taken.
And we all have poems or songs or books or paintings or dance we've seen or music that is so personal to us, even though we may be centuries apart from the person who wrote it or painted it or who danced it. We may be different ages. We may be different genders. We may be different nationalities. We may be different everything. But if that story or that poem or that whatever speaks to us and helps us grow and change and learn and find who we are, that's magic.
Yes.
That's the deepest, deepest, deepest kind of of personhood, personal, I don't even know the words for it, but and it doesn't happen with every book, and it won't happen to you with every book of mine.
Right.
I have 300 and next year 66 books. Next year you can read a book of mine every day of the year, even on leap year. And maybe only one of them, maybe none of them, but at least one, if I'm lucky, will be that book for you. That book for the 4-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 7-year-old, the 10-year-old, the 15-year-old, the person who is going through a bad patch in their lives, someone who is dying, someone who has just lost someone who is dying, someone who is celebrating the birth of a child. And the story or the poem that they take only has the way they take it has only the slightest bit to do with me. It has everything to do with them. Everything.
Yes. When you write, the question I'm dancing around with in my head, put simply, is why do you write? What compels you to write? But I wonder where the balance is there in the lore of this magic, knowing the potential that our words have, or maybe just being compelled to express through those words. What is that for you, writing?
Well, I've written, as I said, over 365 books, because I have more in the pipeline that are coming out. But almost everyone has a different kind of story to it. How Do Dinosaurs Say Goodnight started because my editor called and said, my little boy Robbie can't go to sleep, and he loves dinosaurs. He hates going to sleep. Can you do something for him?
No. Really? That was it? Oh, that's awesome.
Now, Robbie has just graduated from college.
Yeah.
But this was when he was 3. And I wrote this little rhyme for him, not knowing it was going to start an empire.
You started with just a rhyme that you like wrote, emailed, whatever, to your editor.
Yes. I think I faxed it.
Yeah, there you go.
And she faxed it back and she said, I love it. And I thought it'll make a sweet little book. Didn't expect anything of it because everybody had a dinosaur book on their list and everybody had a going to bed book on 3 or 4 of them on their list. Then she found Mark Teague and different kind of magic happened. But also, when I wrote Duck Pond, it was because I had written on Bird Hill and the publisher asked for another book to go along with that. And so I wrote on Duck Pond. And as I started it, it just simply sort of went along and the ducks moved in. And I have seen this hundreds of times on hundreds of different kinds of ponds and in rivers where the ducks move in. It's like the water was smooth and then it breaks apart in little shards, because the ducks are writing their own little script on the top of the water. And everybody scatters because, they're just loud. It's like some gang broke up your party, right? You have this quiet time and suddenly they come in and they're going quack, quack, quack. And they're just paying no attention to you. They're just moving along and then off they go again. They're taking their gang off to the next party. But suddenly I find myself writing about how slowly everything comes back, the quiet comes back to the pond, the stuff that made every creature in that pond happy to live there reasserts itself. And then I found myself writing, the ending. The little boy who is the observer says, an understanding quickly dawned. We shared a shock and now a bond. And I was feeling very fond of everyone one old duck pond as I walked home. And we've all had those kinds of shocks. Some of them are horrible shocks. 9/11, horrible shocks. I'm a New Yorker born and bred, but I haven't lived in New York in like 55 years. But I am a New Yorker. And I was in Scotland at the time and watching on the screen, and everything shattered. Everything. People were shattered. Lives were shattered. New York was shattered. And they came back together again. They found a way to come back together again. When my husband died, I was shattered. But he had left a letter saying to the children and me, I know everybody will grieve for a while, but don't let that define you. You know, live again. And it was that piece of writing on that piece of paper that made me move forward. You see people all the time. Whatever happens, they move forward. You get a bad grade, you pick up your socks, you know. You break up with a girlfriend or a boyfriend and you go, oh, life is not over. You know, there's more to the world than this shatter or that shatter. So in a sense, Duck Pond on Duck Pond became bigger than it was meant to be.
Yeah.
And I didn't try to put it there. It just, for me, was very resonantal. It resonated down to my, you know, my toes. And as I wrote it, it turned, you know, it made a deep left turn and started making itself. And that sometimes that's fun when that happens. That's always a surprise and always a delight when it happens. But sometimes you write something and it just sits on the page and it could be funny. It could be serious, but it hasn't done what Duck Pond did. You picked it out. I thought that was interesting.
I have, this is the thing that, there's a line I'm going to say now from this book, and I want to say it before we leave as well, because of just the way that I think it speaks to the nature of every single interaction we have with every single thing in our day, in our life, and it goes like this. And my reflection, too, looked strange. Every part of me was changed. I looked like I'd been rearranged. And that, my God, I looked at that book, I looked at that line, I felt those words, and every time I read it to my boy, I stop there, and I'm like, this child on my lap that has rearranged the way I see myself, that has rearranged the story that I thought I would have 5, 10, 20 years ago, and how every other person in my life and everything that I experience throughout the day is just rearranging. That line is just, man, I just need it to be in the air. But you spoke those words, and it's that. Mm-hmm. It's that big magic that's working through those words.
Yeah, and you know what? You're not always, as a writer, aware that you've done that. I have a novel, Devil's Arithmetic, which is a Holocaust novel. And I was asked as one of the writers and illustrators after a horrible, horrible shooting event where the crazy man killed all those children and teachers and in Connecticut. And we were asked to come and read to the kids and talk to the kids. And, you know, you search in your heart, what are you going to say to kids who have been through the worst possible thing they'll ever be through, you know, go through? Ever, because every child in the schools that we visited, that school was no longer in existence. They, you know, that They couldn't stay in that school.
No.
I thought, what can I read? And then I got out this Holocaust book that I'd written 25 years ago. It was published. And I was talking to the eighth graders. So I set the scene a little bit. And I told them, I'm going to read you from this section where the one girl who has gone back in time to the time of the Holocaust is trying to understand, one, how she could be there, how she could be two people at the same time, this girl back in the Holocaust, and now she's getting her memory back. And she says, why didn't we pick up guns? We don't have guns, her friend says. Why do we use knives? She says, we don't have knives. Now, they're in a concentration camp at this point. And then the friend says, you want to be a hero like Joshua at Jericho. But you are a hero. I'm a hero. We are all heroes here. And the kids were so quiet because they had been with their friends or their brothers or their sisters or their mothers or their aunts or their neighbors had been in a Holocaust there when this man shot up the school. And for some reason, I picked the right thing to say to these kids. I had worried and worried and worried whether I had chosen the wrong thing. But I said, we are all heroes here. And there was this breath in the room, and you could just hear us breathing. No one applauded, no one had to. It was not an applaud kind of thing. It was a shared recognition between us, all of us.
Yeah, those times when the words exist and they're plucked out of existence in order to be shared among you, they're not any one person's words.
That's right.
Yeah.
Maybe we should tell a funny story now, because we've been very serious.
Well, yeah. But how profound the way that words can reach. Tell me a funny story about words, about your career, about whatever. What's on your mind, Jane?
Well, years ago, I wrote a series of seven books. They're still sort of kind of in print, called Commander Toad.
Yes. Commander Toad.
Commander Toad in space. Now, Commander Toad is bright and brave, brave and bright. He's not terribly smart, but he's bright and brave, brave and bright. And he has a crew of other toads and frogs on his spaceship. And it's sort of like Star Trek with toads, and Star Wars with toads. And as I'm writing it, I realize that I'm telling the story of my middle child.
I love the notion that it's not, I set out to write a story about my middle child. In the middle, you are becoming aware of what the story is revealing to you.
He was about 7, 8. He used to be scared of going upstairs to bed because we had this long, dark hall. And he had figured out this little sort of dance that he would do. He would touch several parts of the wall. He would turn around 3 times, make a sign against the dark, and then he could go to bed. I didn't know this until years later, but I did know that it was a great effort for him to go up the stairs. It was dark. I mean, even with the light on in the hall, it was a very narrow hall. We live in an old farm, New England farmhouse. And I said to him one time, you know, you're very brave. He said, I'm not brave. I said, you are. Because brave, if you're already full of courage, that's not bravery, you know. It's to be brave is to be, first you have to be very, very afraid. And you have to go through that fear and go ahead and do what needs to be done. Every time you go up the stairs, you're a hero. And he looked at me and I said, and he said, I don't feel like, you know, here. And I said, look, I go up the stairs. Doesn't bother me. I'm not afraid. I'm not a hero when I go upstairs. You go up the stairs and you're afraid and you do it anyway. That's courage. And I said, oh my gosh, I've just written all about being a toad in space. It's Adam. So, sometimes you borrow from your family in a funny way, but a very profound way too.
Ah, I love it. Stories all around. And I love the notion too of before where you've written things before a time ago where they meant something to you as you were writing them then, but even to you, the author, they can mean different things at different times.
Well, my husband used to read my stories first. He was the one who read them.
Yeah.
And he was a very good critic too, but he very often explained to me what my stories were about. Because I would write these, I thought these were these just fairy tales I was writing, and suddenly he said, yep, that one's about this, or this one's about your dad and the way he treated you, or this one's about your mom dying young, or this one's about, and I would go, it is? You know, I used to say this was my therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because they came from that very deep, deep place, even the funny ones, that's probably why they can go out and touch someone when that someone needs the story.
Yes. There's a place there. Even the dinosaur books, I can see that tenderness there. The tenderness of being choosy about what you eat or the way that you eat or being a little off or not being able to quite get things right in whatever it is you have going on.
You know, those dinosaurs are really kind of very large toddlers, aren't they?
Yeah.
Or large 4 or 5 year olds. You know, they have a temper tantrum and they simply can't control it. It's bigger than they are and they're very big.
Quite.
But I get letters all the time about those books from people who say, my child would never eat the dinner that we would sit for hours trying to get him to eat. I read the book, How Do Dinosaurs Eat Their Food? And now it says, I'm a good dinosaur. And tries everything. And I'm going, really? Where were these books when my kids were growing up?
Right. No, I'm writing them. Jane, you're doing it wrong. You should be writing them in order to get your kids to do things, not just taking inspiration from them.
I know. Oh, my gosh.
That's hilarious. Now, that one in particular is one that I think has a mainstay in our house, which is why the eating one comes to mind. But that's great. There's a leave.
Please. Oops.
No, I was just going to say the humor to leave. Humor resonates as it does because there's truth there. Because we see ourselves, and when we can see ourselves being ridiculous, suddenly we can be, you know, the anti-example and eat our food really well or go to bed really well because that's what good dinosaurs do.
That's right. But I'll tell you a story that really touched me about those books. I got a letter from I can't remember if it was the mother, the father, or the uncle of a child who had been seriously burned and had been in the burn unit for a number of weeks. And every day they read him How Do Dinosaurs Get Well Soon. And when he was ready to leave, he said, I want to buy a copy of this book for every child at the burn unit. And his parents, or whoever it was, wrote to me and said, how do we do this? How can we do this? And I said, give me a moment. And I contacted Scholastic and I sent them a copy of the letter. And they said, we will send him 100 of the paperback books. And I said, and I will send him, you know, to distribute. And I said, I will send him an autographed hardcover and one of the dinosaur stuffed animals. And we just did it because it was the right thing to do. And then he and his parents called up all the local media and it got to be a big story. But that's not why he did it, and that's not why we did it. He did it because he wanted to thank everybody, and because he saw that there were still kids in the burn unit who needed it. We did it because we saw a kid who was had been very brave, and had been helped by the book, and he wanted to pass it on. So we just sent copies.
The boy had the drive
for publicity at all. And that's what books can do. Yeah. That's what books can do.
They can become part of someone else's story. Look how that book became part of his story, and he wanted to use that tool to help others heal. That empowered him.
Yeah. Part of his story. That's an interesting word. Part of his history.
It is.
The word history ends with the word story.
And imagine how that time in that burn unit and the way that the time with that book was working in him just enmeshed over that time. The healing was healing together. They were grafted together.
Oh, yes.
And the idea that he wants to, in that way, I mean, as well, graft himself to others. Yeah.
I love extended metaphors. There you did it with the graft and the whole thing. Yeah.
It's just a beautiful, it's books. It's a beautiful thing. I'm glad you've lived the life you have to be able to see books connect as they have already with all of the ones that you've shared and with all the ones you will continue to share. Jane, as we wrap up our time together, I want to give you a chance to speak directly to those readers. I'm going to ask you a question that I think many of us that listen to the podcast, but I do as well, share this with students, with children, a message from you. And I'll phrase it this way. I'll see a library full of children tomorrow morning. Is there a message that I can bring to them from you?
I think if I have any message for them, read a book without expectation and let it take you away on a wonderful trip.
The podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 350 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. And Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with the books they'll love. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect any ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Andrea Loney shares Bunny Bear and Take a Picture of Me, James Van Der Zee. Two amazing picture books, each with their own stories of how they came to be. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep and I'll see you there.